The Brief is supported by Bloomberg Connects, the free arts and culture app. Council housing ratcheting up the political agenda ahead of big year of elections. How generative AI is transforming the work of architects and engineers. Heat pump rollout slammed for being too slow. And V&A's director warns the Palace of Westminster is on the brink of catastrophe. My name is Merlin Fulcher. I'm an architectural journalist, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of this week's big stories in architecture, planning, and housing news. Welcome to The Brief from Open City. My guest this week is Miyuwa Oki. Miyuwa is president of the RIBA. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Merlin. Great to be here.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan has pledged to build 40,000 council homes as part of his campaign to be re-elected as London Mayor. This was reported in the AJ this week. Appearing at an event on Monday with Labour leader Keir Starmer, Khan promised, quote, the greatest council home building drive in a generation, end quote. The incumbent mayor, who's currently campaigning for a record third term, pledged to complete 40,000 new homes by 2030, a target which is double what Khan achieved between 2018 and 2024. In his speech, he also defended his contentious ultra-low emission zone for London, which has ignited fierce debate in Parliament, something we covered in last week's show. Khan's focus on housing signals a recognition of the scale of the housing crisis in the capital. There are more than 300,000 households on council waiting lists in London. Meanwhile, rough sleeping in the capital has grown by 50% over the past decade. Khan said on X, formerly Twitter, quote, I grew up on a council estate. I knew firsthand how the security of a council home transformed families' lives. If I'm re-elected, we'll deliver 40,000 more by the end of the decade. Bolstering his move to put housing at centre stage, last week the mayor announced a new £100 million housing kickstart fund to help complete half-built but stalled residential schemes. Khan said the initiative would be used to convert market-rate homes into affordable homes on development sites across the capital, which due to economic conditions have been put on hold after already starting. The kickstart cash will be made available from recycled capital grant funding, that's money returned to the GLA by housing providers, for example, from shared owners who buy a larger percentage share in their home, a process known as staircasing. Okay, so Miyuwa, it seems like social and council housing is rocketing up the political agenda at the moment. Could we expect to see housing as one of the main talking points of the mayoral and general elections, which are all happening this year, most likely?
It's great to see that this issue's being a key talking point in politics and policy. And it's no surprise that it's on a political agenda because, as we know, housing, the built environment is the backdrop to our daily lives. And many, like you said, many people are living in temporary accommodation, substandard accommodation. And what we need is a long-term solution for this. It's taken quite a few years because of the underfunding of this area of our economy. And it's a complex issue. And I think architecture and architects have a role to play in sort of unlocking that sort of logjam, really. So I would say it's good time to be talking about it. We need to be making a concerted effort to deliver, because I am one of the generation that is adversely affected by the chronic lack of funding in our housing system.
If we look at 2023, there were 323,827 households on local authority waiting lists in the capital. That's a huge number of people. I'm sure there were even more people struggling in private rents who want permanent house tenancies. What do you think of this proposal put forward by the London mayor? Does this go far enough in terms of tackling the scale of this crisis?
And it's a step in the right direction, and we always welcome statements and visions that go in the direction or positive direction that we need. We would like to see something done about existing houses, buildings that are non-occupied, we need to understand where the current conditions and have a plan to bring them into use. So yes, I welcome what a London mayor has said, but in terms of bringing new houses on board to solve the issue, but also the issue won't be solved in a singular direction. We need to also take into consideration what buildings, houses, areas that need redevelopment and bring that online too.
So big chunk of RIBA work is effectively like lobbying politicians and government. Like you're the Institute for Architects, but obviously you need to make sure that there's the correct policy environment and economic conditions for your members to flourish. Now, we've got the London mayor elections coming up on the 2nd of May. There's a general election expected this year, potentially very early next year, but you know, it's coming. We know it's coming soon. So what does the RIBA want to see in party manifestos, especially when it comes to housing and the built environment in particular?
So few things. We want to see the revival of public-led house building, which is key to, like Sadiqa said, to delivering homes and places for people. And because it's the backdrop to people's lives, it is that sort of kickstarter to ensure that the rest of your life is you can thrive in. And we also advocate and call in for the issue about quality of new homes. So we've been engaging with the government about future home standards and also calling for new buildings, new settlements to be well-designed, well-connected, inclusive spaces that people can have the highest standards of living. Because like I say, poor quality housing has detrimental impact on the rest of your life, from health to your finances and so on and so forth. So we would like to see government, central and local governments being empowered to resource effectively to promote high quality development, and also demand better from the planning system to raise standard. So for this, we are commissioning some research at the REBA into how funding models for delivering social housings can be developed. And it's something that over the next few months, we'll be looking to share publicly. So watch the space.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I think most people are aware that over the past decade or so, there hasn't been a kind of like shortage of pledges from government that it will deliver housing. However, you know, one day we're told it's planning reform, one day we're told it's getting insurance companies, big pensions to invest in modern methods of construction. Like there's always a different announcement every week. It's really interesting. You said the first thing in your response was public sector led housing, right? And you're saying the RIBA is putting together a report looking at funding options. I mean, what is the scale of public sector housing that's needed here? Because, you know, how do voters make sure they're not going to get fobbed off with something that isn't going to solve the problem?
I wouldn't like to really preempt the research findings, but we have said already the scale is pretty large, and the research will basically detail the level of activity that needs to happen. And it's not going to focus on London, it's going to focus on the UK, because it's an issue that London faces chronically, but it's also an issue across the UK nations and regions.
And if I could just, on that point, drill in a bit, that we know there's discourse around the Green Belt. We know that there's been chat from some of the political parties about new towns, you know, and so on. So what's the emerging RIBA view on like where these new homes are going to go? Because it's a controversial thing, but we know we need more homes. They've got to go somewhere, right?
Yeah. So in the subject of the Green Belt, first and foremost, one of our emerging thoughts is that we need to assess what is constituted as Green Belt, because some Green Belt areas, they're only Green Belt in name only. So they could be part of the sort of areas for redevelopment. So we need to first understand what we're talking about when we're talking about Green Belt and take that conversation forward. But also, we welcome the government's position on brownfield sites as well, which is bringing into use formerly industrialized brownfield sites that have been neglected for over the years. So it's a dual strategy on understanding what is Green Belt, and as well bringing into use brownfield sites that need urban regeneration renewal.
Architecture is thought to be on the brink of a technological revolution, with generative artificial intelligence poised to transform the roles of architects and engineers throughout the built environment sector. An article in Forbes this week looked at how AI is already revolutionizing the design process for architects. However, worries are also escalating over the existential threat it poses to the industry too. Generative AI functionality is already a feature of many CAD tools and graphics programs, allowing architects and designers to explore and evaluate numerous ideas in a fraction of the time. The technology can also be used to create so-called digital twins. These are virtual likenesses of buildings, allowing them to be stress tested against weather, footfall, or earthquakes before any bricks or mortar has made it to the site. Over the past couple of years, popular AI tools such as DALL-E, Stable Diffusion, and Midjourney have proven their ability to generate eye-catching renders in moments, while text services such as ChatGPT and ChatSonic can draft written technical descriptions in seconds. The hope is that this technology will serve to boost the productivity of architects and engineers, allowing them more face-to-face time with clients and residents, the meaningful stuff of architecture, rather than getting stuck on expensive and time-consuming visualization tasks. Zaha Hadid Architects, for example, has already been experimenting with it, priming AI tools with projects, and then using it to prompt new iterations of existing buildings and concepts, for example. However, not everyone is convinced that generative AI spells out a positive future for the built environment. In a recent article in the FT, Edwin Heathcote spoke to the urbanist Adam Greenfield, who warned that architects have not yet woken up to the threat to their profession. So Greenfield said, quote, AI will strip away virtually everything that an architect does. This is existential for architects. The people who are now most enthusiastic about AI have no idea what's going to be done to them. Greenfield goes on, what we need to ask at this stage is, what are we here for? If we're not here to bring our life experiences to bear on complex problems through our creativity, then what's left? Eat and shit, he asks. Greenfield goes on, the things AI is being called to do are the things which give us a stake in existence. Right, that's pretty heavy. Okay, so Mia, what's this all about? How has AI shaken up your life, for example, as an architect? Has it been useful? Are you feeling a bit existential over it?
I believe AI and digital tools are sort of inevitable. In terms of how we can be more productive as a sector, as human beings, I believe that we need to be optimistic, but cautiously optimistic about it. And the future, I believe, is not determined. It's not set in stone. We have to define what future we want, the relationship we want with technology, and get there. It's similar to any other digital technology that we've had, with CAD, which is computer-aided design, and BIM, which is building information management. And this is another iteration of that. And what we need to do as architects and as designers, we need to harness the opportunity of it to make us more productive, to make us more resilient, to understand how we can build sustainable designs and architecture at a scale and pace that is needed. So we're talking about big issues like solving the housing crisis. If we can get through the wonderful iterative process of design quicker, that means we can get things to planning quicker. And if planning decision making is quicker, that means we can get, like, it's basically cascades down the line. So I encourage the intelligent use of AI tools and systems to help us accelerate progress.
I'm loving your optimism, Miura. I mean, it sounds like you had a really good experience when you played around on ChatGPT and Midjourney.
I was part of that cohort again, coming into university and architectural education, where it took hours and potentially sometimes days to render an image, right? And you're telling me now that people in the university are rendering in seconds. And I think that can be only seen as positive. But yes, there is issues with data and copyright and things like that. And that's why at Reba, we have a new expert advisory group on AI. And the group will be building on findings and learnings and practice and theory about the ethical, broader ethical, the professional and competitive implications of integrating AI in a sort of more global architectural professional setting.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, especially that reference to the architecture school, and you think about you know, democratizing an end of year show where some people have got maybe an unfair advantage, maybe access to more money, which allows them to create a really showy model, a really showy display. But then there are some that will say, oh, you know, but making these things by hand, like drawing by hand or making a model by hand, this is part of the learning process. It's part of what allows us to make better architecture. Now, yeah, you know, if we're moving into a phase where we could have AI-generated buildings which haven't gone through those processes, do we risk losing a lot of that humanity and creativity just at the time when we know we need it most?
Yes, it's fair to say the guardrails are put by the type of software that you use, right? But it's also incumbent on all of us, the architectural creatives, to challenge those systems to create, to help us create things that we want to create. And again, I see AI as a tool. It is not the end. Yes, there could be a future where architect or the creative person is detached from it, but that's not the future that I want. I want AI help to release or alleviate the inherent sort of power structure where the emerging practitioner is tasked with sort of the grunt work, so to speak. So I believe in some ways it will help democratize, yes, and also help alleviate, speed up that process of thinking so that, yes, we can do stuff by hand, but it also helps with the machinations of delivering on time and on budget and things like that.
The UK's heat pump rollout has been slammed for slow delivery by the public spending watchdog just days after the government postponed a vital scheme designed to increase the rate of installations. This was reported in The Guardian this week. So a report by the National Audit Office, that's the NAO, found there would need to be a staggering 11-fold increase in the rate of installations if the government is to meet its own target for 600,000 heat pumps installed every year by 2028. By December 2023, the number of heat pump installations was less than half the number anticipated, with the government's progress in making households aware of low-carbon heating alternatives blamed on slow take-up by the public. A whopping 18% of the UK's greenhouse gas emissions come from heating in homes. Unlike gas boilers, heat pumps use electricity, which is increasingly coming from renewable energy in the UK. So last week, the government announced it would be delaying a key scheme requiring heating installers to fit more low-carbon heat pumps by a year, with experts warning this will make targets even harder to reach. The scheme, which is called the Clean Heat Market Mechanism, would require manufacturers to meet a gradually rising proportion of their installations with heat pumps. Together with a grant scheme, this was expected to deliver two-thirds of the installation target by 2028. The commissioner at the National Infrastructure Commission, that's Nick Windsor, said, quote, "The NAO highlights that government current plans appear insufficient to meet its ambition of installing 600,000 heat pumps a year by 2028, or helping the 8 million homes who need to switch from fossil fuel boilers to electrified heating by 2035 to meet climate targets." Okay, so Miyiwa, by the government's targets, only 55,000 heat pumps were actually installed in 2022. With nearly a fifth of the nation's greenhouse gas emissions coming from heating our homes, what needs to be done to speed up this shift to greener alternatives?
There needs to be a long-term investment and action plan from the government and working with industry. We've seen too many schemes come and go to try to address and solve the issue. I think heat pumps are one of the ways in which we can achieve sort of low carbon, net zero carbon future. But we can't rely all solely on that to decarbonize the built environment. And this is why an integrated natural retrofit strategy on all the different points, the different steps you need to take, and how you can, the funding mechanism where you can call on as a domestic homeowner or as a property owner, asset owner, to make sure that the plan is a react can be delivered. So I also call on further research into new technologies which will become more available to help advance this decarbonizing agenda.
Is there something that could be done to go a bit further? Because if you think about it, like most people, if their boiler breaks, plumber's going to come around and they're going to recommend a new boiler, which is the cheapest option, a gas combi boiler, right? And you know, that same plumber can fit a heat pump, right? And it will be a bit more expensive. It won't be wildly more expensive, but it's just not really presented as an option to most people. But like, hey, cast your mind back like a decade ago, and like light bulbs, like we had the incandescent light bulbs just phased out. Like you cannot buy them. You know, you had to get a fluorescent one, an LED one, and that's at the consumer moment of purchase. Like is there a feeling like, you know, it's 2024? Like, why are we still, you know, a plumber will recommend a gas combi boiler still because it's the cheapest option. And that's what most people want.
Because it's a little bit complicated to get an air source heat pump. Again, that's part of this whole detached, sort of isolated way of thinking about it. Because my sister has looked into upgrading a home. And as a professional in the area, I couldn't give her a sort of site to go to and say, this is the step-by-step process in how to decarbonize your house. And that is the challenge there. A novice or a sort of layperson does not know, because of the stop-start nature of all the schemes over the years, no one really understands where to go and what information is out there. And the steps that they need to take to help reduce the energy bills, because that's what everyone wants now. Everyone wants to reduce the energy bills. But I think, again, calling for the National Retrofit Strategy, a single source of information in terms of funding, as well as the step-by-step process in which you need to decarbonize in your home is available. And then I call on industry to take part in that strategy.
So Miyiwa, at the climate crisis, it was a key element of your manifesto that got you elected as RIBA president. You were calling for a fundamental shift in our approach to greening the built environment. Perhaps you could tell us a bit, like, what are the actual challenges for leaders such as yourself? Obviously, we're seeing that the government's struggling. What's the reality of like it in your experience when it comes to bringing about ambitious change on climate in these leadership roles?
One of the challenges is about collaboration and getting consensus across the built environment. As we know, the built environment contributes to 37% of global greenhouse gases. And one thing that I've come to understand, which is a piece of work that's been going on over the past few years, is the UK Net Zero Carbon Building Standard. It's a tool, it's a piece of work, it's a standard that has brought together institutions like us, the RICS, the Institute for Surveyors, the UK Green Building Council, to set a standard that focuses on whole life carbon, to bring a little bit more clarity in the UK market, in the UK industry, about what is required on an asset level, a building level, for a net zero carbon building, following science. And with that, there's also a building environmental carbon database for all the professionals engaged in this work to document their information so that it sort of creates a feedback loop. So those are the challenges in terms of like collaboration. But as you say, the net zero carbon building standard is something that's going to be shared later down the line this year. And again, it will help all of us in the built environment to sing from the same hymn sheet in terms of when we're delivering a net zero carbon building, we're doing it according to a standard that we have all agreed to.
So, and just zoning in on RIBA and the RIBA presidency, what are the ways that you can be most impactful about in bringing about a green transition? And what would you like to see your successor, the next RIBA president, doing to take things further?
I think more active engagement with local government, central government, and also international government. So, for example, we've been responding and engaging actively with the Department for Leveling Up on the Future Homes Building Standard. We've also been engaging with the Buildings Breakthrough at the UN Buildings Breakthrough in Paris a few weeks ago. And all that sort of creating consensus and also sharing the work that the UK is doing to drive this change is what I would implore my successor to continue to fly the flag for and engage in.
The Palace of Westminster, designed by Augustus Pugin and Charles Barry, is falling down and no one is prepared to act. This is the warning from V&A director Tristram Hunt, written in the Financial Times this week. Decades of neglect have left the Gothic Revival building occupied with an army of rats and mice, smelling of damp, with falling masonry, and the hidden threat of fire, asbestos, and dodgy electrical infrastructure. I mean, that sounds like a house of horrors. In 2012, a survey of the building found that, quote, fundamental renovation can no longer be avoided, end quote. Then in 2015, another report urged the, quote, complete decant of MPs, an estimated cost of £4 billion. So in 2016, the palace was described as, quote, an impending crisis which we cannot responsibly ignore, end quote, by the Joint Committee. And in 2022, a sponsor body was assembled to deliver two plans, estimated at between £7 and £22 billion. Shortly after this, the sponsor body was dissolved, and plans to renovate the historic building came to a halt. So this week, it was reported in My London that a decision on the restoration will now be delayed until after the general election. Tristram Hunt, who is also a former MP, writes, quote, we should approach the restoration of Westminster as an opportunity. UK politics needs a symbolic shift. There is a psychological benefit for our sadly reviled MPs of changing spaces and working patterns for a while. There's the opportunity to exhibit these great art collections in unexpected settings, open to the public as never before. Tristram Hunt goes on, Parliament has a responsibility to itself and to the collection it holds in trust for the nation to stop dodging the decision to restore the palace. Okay, so Wiyiwa, why is it so shocking that this symbolic building is in such a state of disrepair and that nothing really substantial has been done about it, despite what feels like years and if not decades of warnings?
Unfortunately, I haven't had the pleasure to go there, but we're facing something similar at 66 Portland Place, Rebo H headquarters. And I suspect, I don't have any details, I don't want to comment on anything to do with the past Westminster, but it's to do with the funding available and how the scale of the project. And I say, you delay it, the more potentially the increase of cost that will be associated with the restoration and refurbishment of it. But it's part of the UK fabric, is part of our identity as Britain, and it needs to be a space where, you know, the decision that shapes all of our lives, you need the home for that to make it happen. And again, it sort of ties into the National Retrofit Strategy, so work to do with heritage works is also part of restoration and retrofit. And It's not surprising that it's in such a state of disrepair, since no major improvement has been done to it since it was first designed. So I urge, you know, MPs to come put their head together and find a way through the quagmire.
So the RIBA itself, it's got ambitious plans for a House of Architecture overhaul. This was something which was started by your predecessor, and it's focusing on the building, the sort of symbolic home of architecture, 66 Portland Place. For anyone who doesn't know it, it's just north of Oxford Circus behind the BBC headquarters. Now, obviously, there's some parallels. Like, you know, you're another organisation with a big building, very famous building, and there's this big investment programme under your stewardship. Why is it so important that something like this goes ahead? Why is it so important that 66 Portland Place continues to move with the times and gets that fair share of investment in its maintenance?
With 66 Portland Place and House of Architecture, it goes beyond just the upgrade to the building. It's about setting ourselves for the 21st century. Similar to the Westminster, we haven't upgraded or had any alterations or amendments to the building since it was built. The House of Architecture project is about our collections. It's about making sure that we are more have a digital platform that we can engage with our members, because we have growing membership in the UK, outside of London, and across the globe. So engaging them in digital means for those who can't access the building. But also, it's about investing in a building and bringing it up to standard for fit for the 21st century.
Okay, so fantastic. We're moving on to the culture section. So coming up in London, interesting cultural events. There's a new exhibition at the Now Gallery in North Greenwich, which is over in our territory here by the Design District. It's called Like a Melody, Myths, Memories and Fantasy by the rising artist and illustrator Charlotte May, open to the public from the 29th of March through to the 2nd of June. So a great opportunity to sort of gaze into an otherworldly realm through paintings, giant figurines and sculptures of ancient artifacts from a parallel universe. Also, for those who like their art outdoors, there's a new Banksy mural has popped up in Finsbury Park after the last one that happened in Peckham, which we covered on the show, which sort of disappeared within 48 hours or something. It's probably a good idea to go and see this one sooner rather than later, sadly. The sort of moving nature of these artworks hopefully does not follow through on this occasion. It stays there forever. But if you want to see it, the artist has claimed responsibility for it on their Instagram post on Monday. There was some speculation about it. It's on the side of a building on Hornsey Road. It features a swathe of green behind a pared-back tree to give the appearance of leaves. And there's a stencil of a person holding a pressure hose next to it. So, Miyu, what's on your cultural radar this week?
I got the pleasure to walk through our Rebirth exhibition this morning. The exhibition is called Wide Angle View, and it's a photographic exhibition that goes through the lens of a series of architectural review magazines in the late 1960s. And it discusses this idea that called the Man Plan, which was exploring architecture's impact on society from a human level, human scale level. And it looked, it was a series of eight different architectural magazines, very provocative. It looked at housing, it looked at education, it looked like as a religious venues, and how architects can be creating works that allow human beings to thrive in them. But also, in more different types of culture, I got a privilege to see the opening show of this musical called Standing on the Sky's Edge, which is a musical about Park Hill in Sheffield. It's a fantastic musical. It talks about Park Hill, the flats. Again, around that late 1960s development that ushered in a wave of positivity and also showed how architecture affects people's lives, because people were coming from slums into what was at that time modern buildings with, like, I think they made a joke about it. It had a dishwasher and this waste disposal unit, which was high-tech technology back then. So it's something fantastic that I've got the privilege to see, and I'm hoping to see it again, actually, before it leaves theatres.
Fantastic. Some hot cultural tips for our listeners. Miyua, it's been an immense pleasure to feature you on the show. Thank you so much. Where should listeners go so they can stay up to speed on your work and your writing? Is there like a website or social media handles that they can check in on?
Yes. So I regularly write a feature on the Reba Journal. So please go there and see my thoughts and musings of the particular month. Also, you can follow me at muiwa.oki on Instagram, muiwa_oki on X, formerly known as Twitter, and on LinkedIn, muiwa_oki. So yeah, and also follow RIBA at architecture.com.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Brief from Open City, made in association with the London Society and the 20th Century Society. This show is made possible in part thanks to Bloomberg Connects, a free digital guide to art and cultural organisations around the world. A link to download Bloomberg Connects is in the show notes. If you've enjoyed The Brief and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to The Architect's Journal, which covers all these issues and many more. To get early ad-free access to The Brief and support Open City's wider work, empowering young people from underrepresented communities, please become an Open City friend today. The link is in the show notes. The Brief is produced by Poppy Waring and hosted by Phineas Harper, Merlin Fulcher, Cyber Chadder and Fran Williams. The series editor is Merlin Fulcher. Our theme music is by Chris Zabriskie. Open City is dedicated to making cities everywhere more open, accessible and equitable.